Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. Even before the entry of Senator Albert Gore to this year's race for the White House, environmental issues were likely to play an important role in this year's elections. Results of a Times Mirror Roper survey straight ahead. Barbara McMartin, portrait of an environmentalist. Also, Yellowstone geysers being threatened. With his church being built near the park, Ed Francis is being prevented from using geyser hot water to heat the building. Seeking compensation, Francis is steamed.
While they make the point that we should not play fast and loose with the environment, I can agree with that, and I think most Americans agree with that. But they shouldn't be playing fast and loose with the Constitution.
The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. Environmental protection and a healthy economy are not mutually exclusive, but can and must go together. This is the conclusion of a nationwide survey sponsored by the Times Mirror Incorporated Conservation Council. Dr. David Rockland, Executive Director.
I'd say the biggest number, the most important sort of mood result we get from this survey is that 92% of the public believe that there's a balance to be found, and a balance can be found, between the environment and the economy. This is the strongest result of the many, many questions we ask that we get, that 92%, almost everybody in the country, really feel a balance can be struck between the environment and the economy. In fact, 58% of the public strongly believe this to be the case.
Rockland delivered the results to a New York City conference of the League of Conservation Voters. What these numbers indicate, according to Rockland, is that as we head to the polls this November, environmental concerns will play a key role influencing which candidates get the vote.
We asked, do you need to have environmental degradation is that the price you have to pay for progress? 28% believe that indeed is true, but about 70% believe that that's a false choice. In other words, the public, people who are running for election this year, who are articulating that we have to make a choice between the environment and the economy, are really talking about a false dichotomy in terms of what the public thinks about this issue. We did also ask, though, if you have to choose, which do you choose? And overwhelmingly and consistently, the public falls on the side of environment, about two-thirds selecting environmental protection is much more important than economic development. Now, a point to be made right here, we did this surveying in late February and March of this year. And while we still have a lingering recession, the recession was a lot stronger then. So these were almost conservative or worst-case estimates, because this was a time when the public, as they still are, were focusing very much on jobs and fear for losing their own job. And so when you see the environment coming out so strong when compared to environmental protection, remember, this is occurring during a time where there's a recession.
Rockland says the poll was structured in such a way that enabled the poll takers to assess not only what our overall opinion is, in other words, are we in favor of environmental protection, but the poll also delved into what we think about specific areas or topics. For example, there are two approaches toward environmental protection. There are the conservationists, those who favor using our resources, but doing so with care, and there are the preservationists, those who hold that some resources, whether they be forests or minerals, for example, ought to be set aside and never used. Rockland says the survey indicates that 70% of us are conservationists, 26% are preservationists, and this pattern showed up in answers to questions on all topics, for example, wetlands.
The public does feel that we need more efforts to protect wetlands. Efforts to, in the Section 404 of the Clean Water Act to get away from protecting wetlands, as there are proposals in Congress right now to do. The public doesn't buy it. The public would like to see more wetlands protection. They also, in other results of this survey, put wetlands protection ahead of economic development and also the protection of private property rights.
One of the most interesting and emotional sets of answers were those over endangered species.
Basically, in the area of endangered species, you see the public really balancing, really making a pragmatic choice about how far to go in protecting endangered species. The sum of their feelings are basically, yes, we need to protect endangered species, but almost on a case-by-case basis. We do need to weigh the cost, and cost figures very heavily in the public's mind as they look at endangered species protection.
Related to the endangered species question was one that asked who should play God, a reference to the so-called God Squad that deliberated on the fate of the spotted owl. Who should decide which species live and which die?
What we saw is that 68% of the public would like to see either university biologists, they were first with 39%, or environmental groups with 29%, make the priority decisions about who should protect or which species of endangered species. Which species that are endangered do we need to protect first? Interestingly, Congress got 2%, federal agencies got 7%, the courts got 2%. There's a very strong message there that the public would like to see science determine which species we protect and how we protect endangered species rather than politicians.
The survey also asked questions regarding the use of public lands. Should federal lands, for example, be open for timber harvest, grazing, and mining? And if so, how should this use be compensated?
We found very consistently, in almost a hierarchy, those uses of public land that are extractive, that are non-renewable uses, the public feels most strongly that they ought to pay the public for the use of those public resources. Those renewable resources, public doesn't feel quite as strongly about, but for commercial uses, they feel that, yes, those commercial users should be paying. The real message that we got out of these data in particular was that the 1872 mining law that's up for reconsideration right now ought to include a royalty payment, and also that below-cost timber sales should no longer be occurring.
Another battery of questions had to do with how to pay for the programs we say we want. Here again, Rockland says, we were straightforward and no frills in our responses.
Public would not like to see new taxes, even where the results or the proceeds, are specifically dedicated to environmental programs. Instead, they'd like to see a shift from other federal programs to environmental programs, the ones that come first and foremost in the public's mind being defense, foreign aid, and health care.
As we mentioned at the outset, this survey was delivered and analyzed at a conference of the League of Conservation Voters. The League targets Democrats, Republicans, and any other party affiliation, the purpose being to educate voters not only about the issues, but perhaps more importantly, the individual candidates. Anticipating this, Rockland says, the pollsters asked whether anyone had voted based on a candidate's environmental position.
18% of the public has made that choice before. When we narrow the field, though, down to those people who respond they're going to vote this fall, 22% of likely voters this fall have in the past used the environment as a litmus test in selecting a candidate. Now, we didn't ask the questions, and this is an important number. 22% may not initially sound like a lot, but when you think about the number of issues that are out there for a voter to look at when looking at a candidate, the economy, healthcare, education, 22% is a big number, but it's also important that we found, though, that yes, these people tend to make an environmental vote, but not all 22% can we say for sure are voting environmentally, in other words, selecting the environmental candidate for sure as they make that vote.
So who is the environmental voter? Rockland says many, if not most, voters expressed concern and awareness of the broad issues, air pollution, solid waste, energy, and the like.
But on ecological issues, sort of longer-term concerns, such as wetlands and endangered species, you see the green voter way out in front of the general public. That brings us to really our conclusion of this report, which is that we see these ecological issues as the ones that will be first and foremost in terms of what we think about and address as the 1990s progress. If the green voter is the one that pushes the frontier of the environmental thinking, it's going to be these ecological issues that we hear more and more about as we move through the 1990s and into the next century.
Dr. David Rockland, Executive Director of the Conservation Council of Times Mirror Incorporated, speaking to a conference of the League of Conservation Voters in New York City. The survey, based on a telephone interview of 1,200 citizens, was conducted for Times Mirror by the Roper Organization. Times Mirror reaches 30 million readers through its publications, which include Outdoor Life, Field and Stream, as well as the Los Angeles Times and New York Newsday. 2 weeks before the election, Times Mirror will be publishing a 16-page voter's guide to be inserted in all of their publications. This is Bruce Robertson. And now, a portrait of an environmentalist.
That green berry that's about to become white, that doll's eye, is very definitely a native of the Adirondacks. And that the leaf beside it, which is not yet blooming, is my pink turtle head, and that's a native's. And down here I've got cardinal flowers that will be out soon.
Dr. Barbara McMartin leans over her garden, carefully inspecting each flower. Clusters of blue and yellow blossoms grow around her home and under a wide porch overlooking Canada Lake. It has been a cool summer in the Adirondack Mountains of upstate New York, but most of McMartin's flowers are thriving. Many are native to the mountains, like the Jack in the Pulpit and the Trillium. McMartin herself is a native Adirondacker. Author of 11 regional hiking guides called Discover the Adirondacks, McMartin recently received a prestigious award, noting her hard work on behalf of the park and its people. Her peers describe her as an environmentalist who can recruit just about anyone to her cause, having spent every summer of her life at Canada Lake at the southernmost tip of the Adirondack Park. Despite her love of the outdoors, at first she pursued a career in mathematics, but one summer vacation in the mountains was enough to make her leave her academic career.
I was finishing up a PhD in mathematics, and I had three teenage children at the time, and I was teaching also. And I was going crazy with work. And one summer I decided to completely take off and do nothing but hike again, which I hadn't done in the previous decade probably, with all the studying and everything. And I started taking notes, and I started having fun, and then I started writing guidebooks, and then I decided not to teach or not to work. And it was interesting. For several years, I got very involved in learning what the park is all about. I think I've been to more places than any single person. I mean, I have been all over the park and have enjoyed it. I mean, I think it's wonderful. I don't have to just be on a high mountain. I can get a real thrill out of a little waterfall or almost anything, or a beautiful open forest. I mean, we have some fantastic forests here in the Adirondacks.
In addition to the hiking guides, McMartin has just finished a book, Hides, Hemlocks, and Adirondack History, the story of the tanning industry in the Adirondacks, the economic backbone of many villages. She began to research the tanning companies after sighting stone walls deep in the woods all over the Adirondacks. She learned these walls were the remains of tanning sites. Such exploring is one of McMartin's favorite activities. She says when she writes, she tries to take her readers off the beaten track.
I don't want to just tell you where to put your feet when you go hiking. I want you to take your head along and think about what you're seeing. Think about the kinds of forests. Think about the history of the areas, where they logged, what people might have lived there, how long these places have been in the forest preserve, and how they were preserved by the state. The natural history, where there are, you know, important stands of plants, flowers, and things. So I weave a lot of different things into my trail descriptions. And I also talk about the trail network in the state was, in the 70s, extremely limited. It's better now. It still is not all uniformly geared for the hiker and throughout the park. There are a lot of places where they're just unmarked trails. But describing one of these unmarked trails or a bushwhack, getting there without any trail at all, it's kind of, it's fun.
McMartin prides herself in bringing together information from many sources to educate readers about the Adirondacks. But many say she also has the ability to bring together diverse people. McMartin was named chair of this year's Adirondack Park Centennial Celebration. It may not sound like a difficult position, but the park is known for its controversial politics. A 1991 state report called for by Governor Mario Cuomo recommended tighter land use restrictions for both the public and private land within the park. The recommendations have yet to be approved by the state legislature. While many support the recommendations, others resent new restrictions on land they own. Because McMartin strongly supports the state recommendations, she had to quell her strong political beliefs when she took over the centennial celebration. She says it was not easy to bring together political adversaries for a celebration.
Early on, when we put all the people from this diverse groups together, it was very difficult to get them to agree on anything. We did agree that we would not be political in the celebration, that it was going to be impossible if we espoused any you know, particular points of view, but we were just going to celebrate. And that worked. And it took a while for everybody to see things in the same way and get together, but it's happened.
For the celebration, McMartin organized artistic and musical events throughout the park. She also planned a lecture series for the centennial. But with the celebration ending, McMartin is now eager to return to her political work. She is considering leading a fundraising group to acquire environmentally sensitive lands throughout the Adirondacks. She is also writing a book titled The History of the Adirondack Forests. She still sets aside at least 2 or 3 days a week for hiking, though she admits she is slowing down a bit. But while McMartin does not like to talk about retirement yet, she is excited about the new generation of environmentalists.
It's going to take a generation, but I think we already have a generation that's become environmentally aware. And I think it'll just continue to grow. There's so many people out there hiking with families, children on their backs instead of backpacks or something. And those people will grow up with a real sense of reverence for the park and the land that we have. Somebody asked me many years ago when I was writing books, and they saying, well, if you send all these people to these places, they'll trash them or something. And I said, no, I don't think so. I think the people who really care about the outdoors won't. And the next thing I heard was one lake that had been trashed because it was too close to the road. I mean, there was just garbage all stuff. A bunch of hikers went and discovered there was a beautiful bog, as I had said, a gorgeous place to look at bog plants, and very easy to get to, and they cleaned it up.
But McMartin's optimism is not reserved for fellow conservationists. She says, despite the controversy over land use, residents in the Adirondack Park have come a long way in protecting their natural resources. And she suggests the rest of the country start paying attention.
We often talk about the fact that this is a model worldwide in a way, because many parts of the world are trying to establish national parks where there is already a lot of development, and they have to integrate patches of preserved with patches of, you know, active agriculture or other things, just as we've done here. And so we talk of ourselves as a model. That's probably a little too self-important, but on the other hand, I guess we are in many ways a model for the rest of the world. And we can show that these things can be integrated, and I hope in the next decade or two we show that the people and the public interest, the statewide and the local interest, are brought together in a closer way to work in harmony.
Dr. Barbara McMartin is an author who has written extensively about the Adirondack Mountains of upstate New York. She also led the Adirondack Park's centennial celebration. She says during the centennial celebration this summer, many residents in the park visited different regions. She says she hopes this will help people begin to view the Adirondack Park as a single entity. Recently, she was awarded the Adirondack Council's Park Heritage Award for her work in the region. For McMartin, this was merely a matter of doing what she loves most. But for those in her community, she symbolizes the driving force behind unity in the Adirondacks. This is Bruce Robertson. Perhaps the biggest attraction in Yellowstone National Park is its extensive system of thermal geysers and mud pots. But some believe new water developments just outside the park could threaten these unique features. After months of delay, a bill to protect the geysers has finally passed a Senate committee. Republican senators from states bordering the park originally held up the measure, believing the rights of private property owners were being ignored. More on the story from Jackie Yamanaka.
Slurping mud puddles, spouting geysers, and brilliant aquamarine-colored hot pools have made Yellowstone National Park a legendary destination for tourists. A number of visitors pull their cars into the parking lot for this attraction, the Fountain Paint Pots. It's located just north of the world-famous geyser, Old Faithful. John Varley is chief of research for Yellowstone. He says this is why the park was created.
It's the reason that Yellowstone is the first national park. That Congress in 1872 drew lines around what was then known as the geothermal features. It was the primary resource that people came to see, and it still is.
But Varley, some other scientists, and environmental groups worry about the future of these geysers and hot springs. They say possible geothermal development outside of the park's boundaries threatens one of the last active remaining geyser basins in the world. About a decade ago, a New Age religious group, known as the Church Universal and Triumphant, moved its world headquarters to a ranch on the north border of Yellowstone. In 1986, it drilled a well on its property and hit hot water. The church wants to use the mineral water to fill a spa and to heat a convention center. Church Vice President Ed Francis says they don't want to harm the park's geysers. He says scientists can't agree if pumping from the well would even harm the flow of hot water in the park. But Francis says if the government is going to prevent the church from using the well, the church should be compensated.
There is no reason on earth why the environment and private property rights cannot both be protected. And I just think that while they make the point that we should not play fast and loose with the environment, I can agree with that, and I think most Americans agree with that. But they shouldn't be playing fast and loose with the Constitution.
Three U.S. senators, Conrad Burns of Montana, Malcolm Wallop of Wyoming, and Larry Craig of Idaho, agree with that argument. At first, they worked on an amendment to compensate the church. But it was dropped after the state of Montana ruled the church was not legally entitled to the water from the well. The state said the church never established a right because it never pumped from the well. But the church says it refrained from drawing water because of the temporary ban on pumping of geothermal wells north of Yellowstone. That federal moratorium expired in April. Francis says finally, out of frustration, the church pumped from the well at the end of June and filled a swimming pool. Francis says it was done to try to establish a legal water right. Then 3 days after the church began pumping, and after weeks of delay, Senator Burns finally introduced an amendment to the geyser protection bill. After the bill passed the Senate Energy Committee, he blamed the U.S. House for the holdup. Burns says if the House had protected the rights of private property owners, then the church would not have resorted to pumping from the well.
It doesn't make any difference on any kind of legislation that comes through this Congress that property rights always have to be a concern. It has to stand the test constitutionally. There is no sense of passing a bill that would make it a lawyer's paradise, that where the citizens of this country has to take to court anybody just to prove a point.
But the amendment says if a landowner believes his rights are being violated, he should go to court. And the sponsor of the bill says that's what the U.S. House agreed should be done. Congressman Pat Williams of Montana.
Well, the senator's statement is merely a cover-up for the fact that they've fumbled the ball and misunderstood the matter of taking for all these months while now Yellowstone is in jeopardy.
At least for now, though, no hot water is being pumped north of Yellowstone Park. The state of Montana asked the Church Universal and Triumphant to stop its activity. The church complied. In the meantime, the legislation to protect the geothermal features is awaiting passage by the full Senate. As it's now amended, all geothermal development on federal land is permanently banned, and there's a 3-year moratorium on private lands within 15 miles of Yellowstone Park. That will give Montana and Wyoming a chance to pass laws to protect geysers. Idaho already has such a law.
Jackie Yamanaka reporting for the High Plains News Service, a production of the Western Organization of Resource Councils in Billings, Montana. And that's our report on the Environment Show this week. We hope you enjoyed the program. The Environment Show is a program about the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. If you know something happening in your area that you think we ought to know about, or if you have a question about this week's or any week's Environment Show, address your comments and your questions to The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. For a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 138. That's The Environment Show, program number 138, 1-800-767-1929. Our portrait of environmentalist Barbara McMartin was written and produced this week by Karen Kelly. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Production, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer, and this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.